their environmental restoration efforts. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In his first presidential term, Trump opened up lands considered sacred to Native people for development, as well as rolling back dozens of environmental protections. In a call of tribal officials, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said she'll stand with Oregon values as the White House changes hands again.
My hope is we will see respect and cooperation from the federal administration to work with our tribes.
Kotek says she's focused on the Columbia Basin Initiative, which worked with President Biden to restore fish runs. William Ray Jr., chair of the Klamath Tribes, then spoke about protecting salmon and two species of suckerfish.
Our biggest concerns about the incoming administration is the water delivery systems and how it's going to affect our endangered species of Tuam and Coptu mullet species. If all the water delivery agreements are going to be fulfilled at 100%, extinction becomes real viable.
Trump has discussed diverting water from the Columbia River to California and also questioned the need for protecting the endangered Delta smelt there. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A new study shows that wildlife migration patterns in the West will likely shift because of climate change. That's why researchers worked with biologists from the Southern Ute Tribe to find out how to tackle the problem. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Researchers used GPS data from dozens of elk collared by the Southern Ute Tribe in southwestern Colorado. They analyzed their current migration patterns and projected how they will look in 2050 as temperatures rise and precipitation declines. They also considered continued growth and development and the traffic that comes along with it. They found elk could be more spread out in the winters as snowpacks shrink. And in the summers, herds could be more compacted as their range is cut by about half. That means new wildlife crossings, like bridges and tunnels, will be needed, says Caitlin Littlefield. She's with Conservation Science Partners and the study's lead author.
Wildlife crossings can enable continued access to new or expanding ranges, or continued access to resources like, say, forage that's shifting in time and space.
Littlefield says the study shows state and federal agencies the need to invest in wildlife crossings that consider the climate's impact on animal movements. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 21st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Harper Mahood, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, Mark Richardson, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Trump's foreign policy appointments, loyalty over competence. China's police and surveillance equipment are everywhere. And at the climate conference, it's all about money. First, Donald Trump's foreign policy appointments. These initial appointments are about what we would expect. People whose loyalty to him is unquestioned and their capability to do the jobs they're assigned is ignored. The appointment of Mike Huckabee as ambassador to Israel is especially shocking, inasmuch as he has denied that Palestinians are a real people and has refused to consider the occupied territories as such. As an evangelical, He will join with the Israeli far right in regarding Israel's expansion as God-given. Then there's the new defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, whose only relevant experience is having served in the military. The Fox News host is a Christian nationalist and far-right megaphone. He is committed to removing woke service heads, such as General C.Q. Brown, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On Fox and other platforms, The Guardian writes, Hegseth telegraphs paranoia and anger toward leftists, an ultra-masculine MAGA persona, and apparent revulsion toward service members who do not fit his vision, including women, unquote. In tandem with that aim, the incoming Trump team is reportedly organizing a group of loyal former military officials who will review the credentials of the top brass and advise on keeping or firing them. For Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, we have two nominees, Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz, who will ensure that China remains the top target of U.S. foreign policy. But at least these two, as members of Congress, are well-read on foreign affairs. That's not true of Tulsi Gabbard, a one-time Democratic congresswoman from Hawaii who became a Trump advisor and is now slated to be Director of National Intelligence. She seems to admire the stability dictators offer. Cases in point are Syria's Bashar al-Assad, whom she met twice in 2017, and Vladimir Putin, whose Ukraine aggression has her endorsement, earning her Russian state television's endorsement as our girlfriend. Matthew G. Whitaker, Trump's nominee for ambassador to NATO, was briefly an acting attorney general in Trump's first term. Whitaker's only known connection with foreign affairs was his skeptical view of the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the U.S. election. On judicial affairs, his views are decidedly Christian nationalist. Judges should have a biblical view, and secular judicial nominees cannot be supported, he has said. For Energy Secretary, we have Chris Wright, who is the chief executive of Liberty Energy, the world's second largest fracking services company, and is one of the industry's most outspoken critics of the effort to combat climate change. There is no climate crisis, he said, and we're not in the midst of an energy transition either. The biggest challenge with climate change, he said, is policies pursued in the name of climate change that make energy more expensive and less reliable. I get the impression that these appointments, hopefully subject to Senate review and confirmation, are designed to put in place weak, unfit individuals who will essentially be figureheads and simply do what Trump directs. They're also a poke in the eye of Washington's foreign policy establishment. China's police and surveillance equipment are everywhere. One of the least noted aspects of China's growing international presence is its police forces and surveillance equipment deployed to numerous countries. The Institute for International Security Studies reports that China exports its surveillance equipment to 50 countries, has bilateral policing agreements with at least 10 countries, and has joint patrol arrangements with 5 countries. These activities are all part of China's so-called Global Security Initiative, launched in 2022 and designed to promote security cooperation with China in areas such as counterterrorism, cybersecurity, biosecurity, emerging technologies, and international policing. That last element incorporates the police and surveillance equipment. Policing is supposed to protect Chinese businesses and individuals abroad, while donating surveillance equipment helps track police targets. In reality, one main purpose of these programs is to popularize Chinese policing and security norms and standards abroad, thus normalizing them internationally, and integrate Chinese technicians and equipment into the security agencies of foreign countries, thus providing China with intelligence opportunities. Recipients of these services, notably in the Global South, but also in Europe and even the United States, get a taste of Chinese methods used at home and often criticized for being part of a ubiquitous suppression of ethnic minorities and dissidents. The overall purpose of these agreements is to gain acceptance of the Chinese idea that enhanced internal security measures are a better alternative than basing or other security arrangements with the West. At the UN Climate Conference, it's all about money. At COP29, the UN Climate Summit, the chief issue was how much money should be raised to help protect poor countries from climate change and where the money should come from. Past efforts to raise $100 billion have taken a great deal of time, and now the discussion is in terms of trillions of dollars. For decades, said Prime Minister Gaston Brown of Antigua and Barbuda, wealthy nations pledged $100 billion annually to support vulnerable countries. Yet these promises have largely gone unfulfilled. Developing countries, including Pakistan, several African nations, and a group of small island states, are calling for big countries to raise that commitment to trillions per year. Many rich countries see climate finance as a random act of charity, said Brown, not recognizing that they have a moral obligation to provide funding, especially the historical emitters, and even those who currently have large emissions, unquote. Wealthier nations have suggested that in addition to new funds from countries like Saudi Arabia and China, much of the money should come from the private sector, not governments. But a growing chorus of world leaders called for a new series of global taxes on fossil fuels and other polluting industries. Last week, President Emmanuel Macron of France, Prime Minister Mia Motley of Barbados, and President William Ruto of Kenya proposed levying a fee of 0.1% on stock and bond trades, which they said could raise up to $418 billion a year. They also suggested taxing the shipping industry and oil and gas producers, which they said could raise another $290 billion annually. The World Bank and other international development banks announced that they were on track to provide $120 billion a year for low-income and middle-income countries by 2030, up from $74 billion last year. But such figures are far from what developing countries are demanding, and 2030 is a long way off for poor countries. In other news, Russia and North Korea have a mutual defense treaty. North Korea clarified a major step in their strategic partnership with Russia that took place when Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un met in June. They signed a mutual defense treaty, which calls for each side to come to the other's aid in case of an armed attack, according to North Korean state media. North Korea's rump legislature has ratified the treaty, and Putin has signed it. The treaty stipulates that the two countries should, quote, immediately provide military and other assistance using all available means, unquote, if either side is in a state of war. That agreement presumably justifies North Korea's deployment of up to 10,000 troops to the front lines in Ukraine. China extends its reach into Latin America. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has inaugurated a huge port in Peru that is expected to attract more than $3 billion in investment, creating a direct route across the Pacific Ocean and extending Beijing's reach into Latin America. Chinese companies are involved in almost every aspect of the deep water port in Chance, which sits 50 miles northeast of the capital, Lima. The high-tech logistics hub will be exclusively operated by Chinese shipping giant COSCO, which in 2019 invested $1.3 billion to take a 60% stake in the project. Chinese state media has estimated the total cost of the finished project to be over $3 billion. U.S. military officials are concerned that the port could one day accommodate warships, though the Chinese assert their interest is purely commercial. The commercial advantages of the port for both countries, Peru and China, is substantial. For China, when completed, the port's 15 docks will be the first place in South America able to host carrier ships too big to fit through the Panama Canal. Chinese researchers have said the route will cut costs and shorten sailing times by 10 to 20 days, attracting businesses from other hubs in the region. For Peru, President Dina Boluarte, who is set to unveil the project alongside Xi, the high-tech center will be a nerve center, joining the continent to Asia, one that could create 8,000 jobs and $4.5 billion in economic activity annually. The Musk effect on China. China is wasting no time appealing to Elon Musk as an exemplar of China-U.S. cooperation. An article in the official People's Daily cites Tesla's remarkable growth in Shanghai after Xi Jinping announced the opening of China's manufacturing sector to wholly owned foreign investment companies. With a $7 billion investment, Tesla, the article says, proceeded to develop a rapid production schedule for EVs that forced Chinese auto companies to follow suit. Thus, quote, China has become the world's most active industrial center for new energy vehicle technological innovation. In 2023, China's automobile exports jumped to first place globally, among which new energy vehicle exports exceeded 1.2 million units, increasing by over 77% year-on-year. The article then extols Tesla's success, which is a model of cooperation. Quote, relying on China's perfect supply chain system and first-class intelligent manufacturing capabilities, Tesla's Shanghai Superfactory has an average of one vehicle rolling off the assembly line every 30 seconds. In 2023, the output of Tesla's Chinese factory accounts for more than half of its global production capacity, of which 36% caters to the export market. Tesla's success in the Chinese market is a process of mutual and multi-win collaboration, aligning with the Global Division of Labor in Industrial and Supply Chains in the era of economic globalization. It exemplifies the philosophy of cooperative win-win outcomes and harmonious coexistence, unquote. The article also mentions the Peru port facility as an example of what can be accomplished through cooperation with China. In light of Xi's congratulatory message to Trump that focused on China-U.S. cooperation, we can expect to read more news from China that demonstrates, as Xi likes to say, partnership over rivalry. Next, Biden lifts a ban on long-range weapons for Ukraine. After many months of refusing to provide Ukraine with the means of attacking deep in Russian territory, President Biden lifted the ban on long-range weapons aid. The ban specifically applied to ATACMS rockets, that's ATACMS, tactical missiles which have a range of up to 190 miles. Ukraine's President Zelensky had been seeking that weapon. Biden's decision may, of course, be reversed by Donald Trump. But the decision comes at a time of relentless Russian missile and drone attacks on Kyiv and the introduction of North Korean troops to the battlefield. Biden's decision draws the U.S. and NATO another step deeper into the war, now 1,000 days long, and moves Ukraine farther away from consideration of a settlement. This escalates tensions to a qualitatively new level, said Kremlin spokesman Daniel Peskov. We will be taking this as a qualitatively new phase of the Western war against Russia, said Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. As though Russian attacks on Ukraine's cities and deployment of North Koreans haven't done that. The New York Times reports, quote, Russia has targeted the capital with more than 2,500 missiles and drones, according to data collected by the city's military administration. And finally, a huge Maori protest in New Zealand. An attempt in New Zealand's legislature to repeal a foundational treaty between Great Britain and the Maoris has led to major protests. The Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840 by a representative of the British Crown and 500 Maori chiefs. In exchange for ceding governance to the British, the treaty promised tribes broad rights to retain their lands and protect their interests. The Maori comprise about 17% of New Zealand's population. But just as has happened in the United States and Australia, original peoples have been shortchanged over time. The protests, not the first over Maori rights, involves a march of over 600 miles to the capital, Wellington, and performance of the traditional haka, or war dance. Even New Zealand's Prime Minister believes the proposed bill is wrong. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Diana McLean Smith, author of the new book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. Welcome, Diana.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here with people from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Absolutely.
I'm excited to speak about this new book with you. Where did the idea come from? Where did you start out with this?
Well, in some ways, it was the culmination of a long career working in organizations with intergroup conflict and trying to figure out how I could convert the conflict into a productive force for change. And during the pandemic and the first Trump administration, it was clear to me that the same kinds of things I was seeing in organizations was happening in our nation. And it worried me deeply. And so I wanted to see what was going on, how did we get here, and is there anybody doing anything about it?
Well, like you mentioned, it's probably not news to most folks that we are politically divided and increasingly entrenched in those divides. This is one of the things you explore in the book. How did we get here?
Well, I think people like to think that it's a relatively new phenomena, but we are a country that has had conflict, intense conflict, throughout the course of our history. And we were founded, in fact, with a conflict between us and the king in Britain. And we had a revolutionary war in order to break free. And we had a Declaration of Independence, which declared all people equal and gave them the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And then that got called into question with slavery. And then we fought a civil war to put that to rest. And then we had the Jim Crow period, the late 1800s, which was marked by a lot of violence. And then we had the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in the middle of the last century. That was marked by a lot of intense conflict. So we've had a history of division throughout our nation's history. But in the last 50 years, something new has happened. And that is, there are a lot of problems around the world that are starting to cross boundaries and reach our shores, and it's making people very nervous. People are on the move in terms of immigration, pandemics are crossing boundaries, climate change is crossing boundaries, terrorism is crossing boundaries. And when that happens, people tend to cling to people who are like them, and they tend to get distant and fearful of people who are not like them. Now, that's always been a tendency we've had as a species, but in times of anxiety and uncertainty, with the trends I've just mentioned, which have become quite pronounced over the past 50 years, it becomes quite dramatic, and people really get quite insular within their own groups and quite hostile and fearful of people who are different from themselves. And that is what we are now finding ourselves having to deal with.
Like you mentioned, some of the divisions are structural, but in your book, you write that there are a lot of examples of people doing bridge building work, and it is something that individuals can take on, even when we're talking about these big structures that are beyond our control. Talk about that part of it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was really taken by is the number of people that I discovered who were, you know, more in common talks of them as the exhausted majority, the 67% of us who are not polarized, who are not extreme. And, you know, the press has to sell papers, and so they lead with what bleeds, and they emphasize that. But there's a large swath of people who are much more flexible politically and much more open-minded and problem-oriented, meaning they want to solve problems. And that's a very large group of people. And when I started doing the research for the book, I discovered that there were not just hundreds, not just thousands, but tens of thousands of people. Really, now I've discovered it's like millions of people across the country working in locally rooted groups that are connected nationally on problems they can solve in their communities, and through solving those problems, begin to make progress across divides. So these are groups that work across partisan divides, across demographic divides, on problems they care about together, and they start to get to know each other, and the divides start to evaporate.
Part three of your book is called Remaking Our Democracy in a New Image. There was a quote that struck me. You write, "Friendship is the great equalizer," and the power of friendship in doing this kind of work. Can you speak to that point a bit?
When I talked about the conflicts throughout our history as a nation, I think one of the reasons that's so true is that we imagined ourselves early on not just as a democracy, but as an adversarial democracy, one where we had two parties who fought with each other in the court system. You have a prosecutor and you have the defense. We have this binary either-or win-lose model of democracy, which is really built on our evolutionary heritage from a time many millennia ago when we learned to live within groups in order to be able to survive. We form groups. And one thing we don't pay attention to, but I think very important, is that we learned to cooperate within groups so we could compete better against other groups. And that made sense for a long time. But now we're in a world, as I said before, where the problems we're facing, they cross groups, and groups have to cooperate with each other in order to solve the problems. You can't solve things like climate change and immigration, terrorism. These are problems that must be solved by groups getting together and cooperating across groups. So one of the things I'm proposing is that if when you have an adversarial democracy, you're thinking always about advancing your own interests. If you imagine your fellow citizen as a friend, which I think you know many of us do much of the time when we're not in the political world, so it's not that big a leap, but if you imagine your fellow citizens as a friend, then you care about their interests, not just your own. So if you don't, you're not going to have a friendship for long, right? So we have to start thinking about not just satisfying our own interests, but how do we address the interests of others? Because for us to survive as a multi-group democracy, we're going to need to do that. Otherwise, we're going to be at this 50-50 stalemate, and we're not going to be able to solve any problems, and we all go down. We all lose.
And friendship is an important component of combating the, you know, the loneliness epidemic that a lot is made of in the press.
Yes. And the loneliness epidemic is, I think, the kindling with which we now have such hot conflicts, because people are so alone and feel so isolated that they're desperate for a sense of belonging. And I think we are all... we all have a role to play and a responsibility in our communities to make sure that everybody has a sense of belonging and a purpose and a role and some meaning. Because if they can't find it in their community, they're going to find it in these dark holes on the internet. People like to think that we can control the internet. We can't. But what we can do is shape our community so that we create the motivation for people to turn to the internet to find the belonging they're not finding in their communities.
In writing this book and talking about this subject, have you encountered any common misconceptions?
I think the biggest misconception that worries me is that we, the people, don't have the power to make a difference, and that we have to cede the ground to the extremists because they're covered so, you know, 24/7 by the press and social media. So I think the biggest misconception is this notion that the people are powerless. We have a huge amount of power, but it isn't just as individuals. And most importantly, like one of the things I tried to drive home in the book, and there are plenty of stories there, is that there really are hundreds of organizations, from Starts With Us to Listen First Project to Urban Rural Action to Not in Our Town. I mean, there are just countless organizations out there that are mobilizing people across divides to work on these common problems. And if we can really lean into that ourselves and join these groups, support these groups, then we have endless power to turn around what I know is driving all of us crazy, which is this endless animosity. It is totally within our control. It is our inability to imagine that. And then my book is just one of many, many resources that people could find to figure out ways that they themselves can become part of the solution and stop becoming part of the problem.
If our listeners are interested in finding more out about you or about your book, what's the best way for them to do that?
The book is Remaking the Space Between Us. And it can be found on Amazon. I also have a website that has a lot of resources, which I highly recommend for people who want to figure out how they can become part of the solution. That's called remakingthespace.org, And there's a section in there on resources where people can get hooked up with different organizations. And these, again, they're in Portland, they're all through Oregon. I mean, there are lots of opportunities for your listeners to get involved. And so I would recommend those two sources. The other thing I want to say is not having to do with my book, but there's an organization called Starts With Us, has a website and has exercises for people. Another one is Good Conflict. These are organizations that can really help you figure out how you can interact with people who have different backgrounds, different views, different political affinities more productively going forward.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
My only final thought is that, you know, it's so tough. I mean, I feel it myself, what we've been going through as a nation. It's so dispiriting in many ways, given how especially how the press covers it. You'd think there was absolutely no hope. It's just not true. There's a huge number of people out there doing wonderful things. And my biggest worry is that people are going to give up on we're going to give up on ourselves as a people, and we're going to give up on each other. And I think we can't afford to do it, and we don't need to do it. There's lots happening. It just will take a little bit of initiative, and I mean a little bit of initiative, to find out where and who and how to plug in. But we can't afford for that to happen. If that happens, then it's all over. And I really think that would be a shame.
Well, Diana, thank you so much for talking about your book with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I so appreciate it.
That was Diana McLean Smith, author of the new book, Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.